A Wednesday Lenten Sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 29, 2000, in the series, What Wouldn't Jesus Do?, entitled, Judging and Condemning is Not Our Prerogative. The texts for the sermon are James 4, verses 11 and 12, and Matthew 7. Verses 1 through 5. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
The word of Jesus in the text of the evening is abundantly clear. It's an absolute, judge not that you be not judged. And when I think about that and have reflected on it in preparation for some reflections with you this evening, I remembered why we were doing this particular series, WWJD. Not what would Jesus do, but what wouldn't Jesus do? And one of the obvious things that Jesus wouldn't do is to judge and to condemn. And so, judging and condemning is not our prerogative. That's the statement of the evening. Not very controversial, really. Nothing new there. Something we all know, that have been aware of, probably throughout all of our Christian nurture and experience. So, nothing new this evening, but just the affirmation of an old truth, which is very easy to understand and very difficult to live by. As I got to thinking about Jesus' statement, judge not that you be not judged, I had to admit to myself why I chose the theme, what Jesus wouldn't do. There was a bit of contrariness in me, a bit of orneriness. I was really speaking out against all of this WWJD, which is symptomatic of a culture that has flaunted Jesus. I'm sort of sick of Jesus flaunting, throwing Jesus in the teeth of everybody. And so I thought I'd be smart and talk about what Jesus wouldn't do. I don't think Jesus would parade his name all over the place. I think it cheapens Jesus and the faith tradition that has stemmed from him. And all of a sudden, I recognize the fact that my little cute theme, what Jesus wouldn't do, was a judgment on those who wear their bracelets. It was my way of protesting. It was a manifestation of the kind of spirit against which Jesus was speaking in the text of the evening. Now, if you don't think that is an unmasking and a fearful revelation, and then you have to go and admit it to your people, that the whole series is an example of what Jesus was condemning. Well, I think I have a point about this flaunting of Jesus, and I was really pleased to come across a piece by Martin Marty in Christian Century. He starts out by saying that he wouldn't recognize Rosie O'Donnell if he bumped into her grocery cart at the supermarket. I'm not sure he's being honest at that point. But apparently Rosie O'Donnell was the Billy Crystal of the Grammy Awards, mistress of ceremonies or something. And she must have begun by saying, I met God backstage, and he said, you're welcome. And as Time magazine reported, she was assuring prospective Grammy winners that each didn't have to thank God in the acceptance speech. And then Martin Marty says, you know, we're warming up for a presidential campaign, and he suggests a public service announcement to this effect by both candidates. Be it noted that all the candidates thank God in advance for all that comes, be it success or adversity. And be it understood that not chattering about it does not mean that they are not genuinely grateful to God. Get it over with in the beginning, and then leave God out of it, for God's sake. So, I was feeling a little better about that, thinking that my distaste, my dislike for this contemporary flaunting of Jesus at every drop of the hat maybe had some merit to it. But then, in the same magazine, I had a little piece here from Greenville, South Carolina, entitled Living with Bob Jones. And it talks about the fact that Bob Jones University is a backward-looking fundamentalist institution coming out of the very, very extreme right, very hard-nosed fundamentalist community. And you know the recent story, George Bush went there and John McCain said, shame on you, and it became a big brouhaha. Well, here's somebody who teaches in a neighboring university who says, you know, there are a lot of those bad things, but they've been getting better. And no one mentioned the fact that they have a fine classical music station, and that a lot of their graduates are upstanding, hardworking people in the community, and that some of their students work in the local hospital as volunteers. And he went on to mention a lot of the good things that were happening and how Bob Jones ever so slightly was edging its way out of that darkness. And he says what the whole episode portends for Bob Jones is unclear. One might hope that the criticism pushes Bob Jones University to become a more open institution, more like Wheaton or Calvin. Open. It seems more likely, however, that the political onslaught will halt its small tentative steps in that direction, especially given the certain resistance to any such move from the vast fundamentalist network undergirding the institution. And then this, whatever happens to Bob Jones University, the whole episode raises a fundamental question. Can those who advance the principle of religious pluralism tolerate and try to understand those who reject such pluralism on principle? I said, ouch again. I find it most difficult to tolerate the people who represent what I've come from. And since I got my eyes open, I don't know why they can't open theirs. And so, I come to this old text of Jesus, which is one of the most familiar because we're always quoting it to one another, aren't we? Judge not, judge not, judge not. And I know what it means, fully aware of it, and fully aware that I don't live it out very well. It's a tricky business, really. The word in Greek, to judge, has a broad range of meanings, and as someone said, you know, if the Sermon on the Mount was for a group of disciples who were waiting for the end any moment, then sure, it's easy to just let go. If it's just an interim ethic, If it's only for this immediate period until the end, then you don't have to work very hard at how to get along in a practical way in an ongoing course of history. But history goes on, and here we are 2,000 years later, and we try to come to terms with the Sermon on the Mount, and we can't live without judging. That is, making judgments. That is, discerning, distinguishing. We have to do that all the time in all areas of life. And so it gets rather tricky. At what point am I being discriminating and discerning? And at what point do I step over the line and become judgmental and condemning? And it's not black and white, and it's not a firm line down the middle somewhere. It's all fuzzy, full of ambiguity. But I think there's no doubt about the fact that we understand what Jesus was getting at. And that is that in our human relationships, parents and children, spouses, esteemed friends, community members, all of our relationships, Jesus said, suspend your judgment one of another. And I suppose he said that because, for one thing, we don't have enough knowledge to judge. We really don't. As James says in the little paragraph we read, that's God's prerogative. If we had God's point of view, we might judge without trepidation. But lacking that, all of our judgments are on partial knowledge and limited insight. We simply don't know enough to judge one another. We don't know the domestic situation from which any one of us has emerged recently. We don't know the particular pressures and tensions under which someone is living. We don't know about the erratic nature of chemical imbalances in brains. We don't know about the scarred psyche that's the result of the damage in childhood that could never fully be repaired. We just don't know enough to judge and condemn one another. And consequently, Jesus says, suspend your judgment. And I think beyond that, he probably recognized the fact that judging and condemning does not build and help to grow and enhance, but is destructive of the other. Judging and condemning another is a kind of murder, a killing of the soul and the spirit. We know enough about that these days. There are so many studies. We've got so many books. We know that it is positive regard that draws out the best of another, and we know that judging and condemning only grinds down and crushes the spirit more than ever. We can see it with children whose bad behavior is made worse. We see it in one another because we never really grow up. We're all children finally in big bodies. I read a little story about a college engineer who was coming to spell some owner of a logging firm out in the Northwest. And the owner, feeling that this guy might be not accepted by his rough and tumble woodsman, said to him, "Now, so-and-so, he'll probably give you a hard time. He's irascible and stubborn, but don't fire him. He's the best woodsman in the Northwest." And the replacement supervisor went down the trail the first day, and he came on Tony, and he said to him, "Tony, you know, the boss says you're the best woodsman in the Northwest." And he went on down to his work. And that night, when closing time came, Tony came up to him and invited him to his home for dinner. And as they shared a meal together, he said, "Did he really say that?" They said, "Yes, he did." He said, "Why hadn't he ever told me?" So I suspect all of that ill behavior was the consequence of failing to be recognized for his merits and his values that he believed in but never saw affirmed. Judging and condemning only crushes the human spirit and grinds a person down more, alienates and disorients and destroys. It's a bad practice. God keep us from it. And judging and condemning is a bad practice, finally, because we all need mercy. I think a fall or two and a flaw or two brought to one's consciousness is a very, very good thing and enabling us to be decent human beings. Because once we've come to terms with our own failures and flaws and shortcomings, negative tendencies and shadow sides, we don't need to go out looking for trouble. We all need mercy. Where would we be except by the grace of God? Where would we be except by those who know us best and love us most? That is the heart and essence of human community. I wonder why it is that this practice of judging and condemning is so endemic to the church. Because it is, isn't it? Probably because here we're dealing with the things that are right at the core of our being and our most ultimate commitments. And so we care the most. Someone has said, I think it's the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference. And maybe the cruelest attitude over against another is indifference. Love me or hate me, at least I know I'm, you know, somewhere in your sights. And maybe it's because in the church, in the church at large, maybe it's because that's where our ultimate commitments are, that we get so jumpy and so defensive and so easily threatened. And we lash out so quickly. But it is ironic, isn't it? Somebody has written a little piece about the fact that the church is the only army in town that shoots its own wounded. And that there is a lot more acceptance the neighborhood bar than in the neighborhood church. And I talked with someone recently who's got a couple of decades of sobriety under his belt, who was giving me the statistics about the AA meetings in Grand Haven. Starting in the morning, going through the evening, all day long. People coming in, sitting around the table. AA doing the church's business, which is accepting and listening, not judging and condemning. Well, nothing new tonight, just Jesus' word, easily understood, very difficult to practice. But once we get a breakthrough and begin to experience and to practice the suspension of judgment and the extension of mercy, we'll find ourselves, interestingly enough, so much happier. And we'll be doing so much good. So, judge not, be merciful, and God have mercy on us all.